Hi, and welcome to episode 3 of Rather Be Reading, the Point Podcast. We know you'd rather be reading, and so would we, but we have some things to discuss. I'm Rachel Wiseman, and I'm the managing editor of The Point. We just came out with our new issue, which features a special symposium by the editors on the question, what are intellectuals for? So in this episode, we decided to talk about something that naturally comes to mind when we think of intellectuals. Desire. In our first segment, Anastasia Berg interviews Andrea Long Chu about her blockbuster debut essay in N+1, On Liking Women, and about what happens when our desires are inconvenient for our politics. Then John and I talked to Rachel Rosenfeld, the founding editor of The New Inquiry and newly appointed publisher of The New Republic, about the history and legacy of Occupy at small magazines in New York. And don't miss our final segment, when we call up John's mom to chat about Me Too, politics, and one of her favorite authors, Doris Lessing.
This is Charitable Reading.
Hi, I'm Anastasia Berg, and I'm an editor for The Point magazine. When I sat down to read Andrea Long Chu's essay, Unliking Women, in N+1, I didn't expect it to reflect back to me so vividly a key aspect of my own experience of being a woman, wanting to be and to have things I shouldn't. The essay, which explores the origins of transness and desire on the one hand and in feminist politics on the other, sparked a debate long in the offing about whether or not desire, and in particular sexual desire, should be seen as the new frontier for social justice. The patterns of desire certainly seem to follow discriminatory pathways. Is there something we could do about it? Must we try? Amiya Srinivasan wrote for the LRB that while no one has the right to demand to have sex with anyone else, perhaps we have a duty to critically engage with our own desire in the hope of rendering it less exclusionary and less unjust. In late April, I sat down with Andrea in New York to discuss this further. So I thought we'd start by just asking you what motivated this article. Is there a backstory?
The story that begins the article is an account of, this is me in high school, long before I've transitioned, I'm on the athletics bus as the manager of the girls' volleyball team, and I'm the only boy on the bus, and we're driving to away games, and it was like this sort of intensely erotic experience for me. And one of the things you do as a trans person, especially if you don't have the luxury that some of us have of sort of having always felt, quote unquote, this way, is when you do transition, you go back and you like look for, okay, so what are the signs? And so I was looking for signs, and this bus ride seemed to be demonstrative of something and of a certain way that I sort of felt without knowing that I felt that way.
You conclude the story of being on the bus by saying, the truth is, I have never been able to differentiate liking women from wanting to be like them. And I think for some readers who are less familiar with how debates within feminist discourse and trans discourse have been going on, this could sound pretty innocent. But actually, this isn't very much an innocent statement at all to talk about liking women and wanting to be like women in one the same breath, because this is the kind of thing or versions of something that sounds like this has been used as an accusation.
Oh, absolutely, right, because there's a long history. I mean, something that's kind of lurking in the background in this piece is that the first accounts of transsexuality, transvestitism, so we're talking about like Magnus Hirschfeld and the Institute for the Study of Sexuality in Berlin in the early 20th century, those first accounts are sexual accounts. One hears an echo of that in the discourse around the bathrooms, for instance, as if the reason that trans women transition is so that they can have easier access to little girls in bathrooms. As a result, we've had a hard time talking about the role that desire, sexual desire, erotic interest, all of those things play in transition, which is, it's so incredibly real.
Why did that become something that got denied and replaced with a model that you discuss of identity?
Well, the problem with the Hirschfeld model or the models that followed, the difficulty with those accounts is that sexual valence that was attributed to transsexuality was like a pathologizing one. So that was a part of a way of marking it as a form of perversion, which is something that, again, continues to today. So that's made it, rightly so, very difficult to talk about the role played by sexuality in transition, in transness, and by extension, not just sexuality, but wanting in general.
TERFs, so trans-exclusionary radical feminists, have a strong connection to something that is captured under the title of political lesbianism. And that's another hurdle that you have to clear in introducing your argument. So you can describe what is that position and what are these connections?
Right. So a TERF, T-E-R-F, trans-exclusionary radical feminist, is this label that has sprung up to describe contemporary iterations of transphobic feminism, which usually go along the lines of something like trans women are in fact men, they are interlopers who are here because they have some kind of perverted interest in invading women's spaces, and they, notably, they reinforce gender roles when in fact the feminist project should be dismantling those roles. So it's really important to say that this is not what we would call a biological essentialist position. This is actually often extremely copacetic with the thing we call social constructionism, which is spoken about now as if we all sort of understand what that means. One of the potentially more controversial things about this article is that I am sympathetic, wouldn't be the right word, but I am generous in how I read TERFs. And I sort of love the idea that TERFs have no idea how much I agree with them about things. Not everything, but a number of things. One of the things I argue is that this name is misleading insofar as it involves implicitly a kind of historiographic move where the radical in trans-exclusionary radical feminist is supposed to signify that the TERF is actually this sort of holdover from the 70s. She was a radical feminist in the 70s, and she just sort of kept being a radical feminist instead of getting with the picture and jumping onto all the other waves. And it's an account of TERF as essentially a kind of anachronism. And I don't think this is true. It is indeed true that there are folks who in the 70s were anti-trans who continue to be anti-trans today. But the implication is that radical feminism as such was completely anti-trans. And that's plainly untrue.
What is the connection to be drawn between today's TERFs and yesteryear's political lesbians? Why is it a connection that's supposed to be productive in introducing another way of thinking about being trans and transitioning?
Political lesbianism was the idea that lesbian is actually a political position, sometimes a spiritual one, sometimes but not always a sexual one. So you could be a lesbian without having sex with women. But that lesbian was a political position that you could choose that represented separatism from men, or at least a kind of strike on heterosexuality. And it had to do, I think, with lesbian as a concept, which no one agreed on what this meant. Today, lesbian is kind of like almost an anachronistic term because everyone is like queer. Lesbian sounds sort of old-fashioned and kind of like dowdy. like you're kind of like, you know, middle-aged and like you hike a lot kind of thing. But in the 70s, I was just reading The Lesbian Tide, which was this magazine from, I think, 71 to 74, something like that. And this particular issue of the magazine was right after this infamous conference known as the Second West Coast Lesbian Conference of 1973. The fascinating thing about this issue is that it's got pieces by different people who are at the conference. None of them agree with each other. There's so much infighting. It's incredible. And one of the things that they're infighting about is the word lesbian. Like, this is called the West Coast Lesbian Conference. No one agrees on what a lesbian is. We wouldn't argue about this now. We would argue about, for instance, what trans means, or potentially what queer means. Those are the terms in which people are storing their political optimism now. But in the 70s, among a certain group of feminists, the term that housed that optimism temporarily was lesbian. Political lesbianism was the height of a kind of contradiction that had developed within feminism, which was the more powerful your critique, the more you could enumerate the ways in which patriarchy functioned on an everyday level, the more impossible it seemed to just like live your life without being immediately subject to all of those technologies of oppression. And so what that produced is a kind of revolutionary subject, the political lesbian, who could, through sheer force of political will, change her own desires.
And so would you say that the analogy between that position and the TERF's position is that in their mind, what the transgender woman does is in fact give in to a certain kind of desires that she refuses to engage with critically?
Yes, absolutely. But I think the other important thing is that trans exclusion, for instance, at the famous 1973 Lesbian West Coast Conference, it wasn't because these feminists were like sitting around and like scheming about how to make trans women's lives horrible. The radical feminist Robin Morgan, who spoke at this controversial conference in 73, says in her speech that there is this, she calls it an epidemic of male style. So feminism has been invaded by an epidemic of male style. And what she means by male style is not actually transvestites, transsexuals, even though that's sort of the extreme example. What she means is like bar butches. Like what she's referring to are women who are like listening to the Rolling Stones or who are collaborating with like the sort of brochelist members of the New Left, or who are just here to fuck and aren't actually interested in the sort of tender, caring, emotional, nurturing environment that the lesbian conference is supposed to be. What happened in the 70s is that maleness was abstracted. You're no longer actually talking about men. You're talking about some sort of kind of structure of relating to other people, which was in itself misogynist, patriarchal, oppressive. That structure could then be repeated all across experience. The dream of separatism was sullied by the fact that when you get a bunch of lesbians on the UCLA campus for a couple days for this conference, they're just like at each other's throats the whole time. The transsexual woman, Beth Elliott, in this case at this conference, is just the last in a whole series of different ways that patriarchy could be smuggled into lesbian utopia. I don't think it was nearly as much about an anti-trans animus as it was about trying to take to its fullest consequences the implication of an analysis. And this is why maybe I have some sympathy for, or why I want to read TERFs generously, is that I think there's a real experience of finding out that critique wasn't going to do the thing it said it was going to do for you. And in its sort of nascent stages, as radical feminist theory was building, the stronger it got, and the more, honestly, compelling that it got, the more one came to realize that it was going to be impossible to live by it.
After this very generous reading, where do you come in the piece?
So I have a lot of sympathy for the separatist position on a personal level because it feels like it's meaningfully descriptive of something that I felt myself in terms of my own transition. It did feel like it was an act of defiance or an act of just rejection. I've never wanted to spend time with men, least of all myself. And so at some point I just put that into practice. I was my own second West Coast lesbian conference of 1973.
And yet,
I couldn't actually embrace sort of the position that, look, like I'm like the most political lesbian that there ever was, because all the things that I want are still completely mired in the same patriarchal, misogynist sort of culture that radical feminists are already describing in the 70s. The TERF position that I would be, through transition, solidifying and reproducing normative gender roles, I find that argument completely convincing. Like, I think it's completely right. Because I know that it's right because it's the thing that I want. Like, I'm not interested, actually. I'm not at all interested in dismantling gender. No, like, I am completely aware that these things are bad for me.
Let me first read something, which is one of the many favorite parts of your article, and then I want to ask you what this claim means. So you say that trans lesbians should be pedestaled as some kind of feminist vanguard is a notion as untenable as it is attractive. In defending it, I would be neglecting what I take to be the true lesson of political lesbianism as a failed project. Nothing good comes of forcing desire to conform to political principle. You could sooner give a cat a bath. In another piece, the piece is called Did Sissy Porn Make Me Trans? And taught me about a genre of porn I was not familiar with, which was exciting. And you say most desire is non-consensual, most desires aren't desired. And so that's one way of hearing your claim. Well, you know, we can't do this. And so why waste our time? And then there's something else. Should we if we could? When you say something like nothing good comes of trying to force desire to conform to political principle, I hear both options. Before you answer, let me just introduce a recent argument made by Amir Srinivasan for the LRB. The main question of her piece is, do we have a duty to try and work on our desires, especially insofar as they're reflective of discriminatory political practices? So it's not just a question of you enforcing the patriarchy by wanting to present yourself a certain way or wanting to be in a certain kind of relationship. She's also talking about the sexual choices that people make, and she's saying many people already know they're exclusionary. They seem to follow certain patterns of discrimination. And she asks whether or not we have a duty. And I think she's subtle in her response, but I think she's leaning insofar as we do. So this is the question to you. Can we not, and should we if we could?
I mean, she isn't really talking about, like, do we need to acknowledge that, like, the rapist's desire to rape is as equally ungovernable as any other desire. The easiest fix there, by the way, is just to say, well, desire and action are different things. So, like, you can't actually, not because you can't ethically, but you can't ontologically tell someone you can't want this because that's just not going to work. But that doesn't mean you can't say you can't do this.
And she says at a certain point, no one wants a mercy fuck.
Right.
And so what she's trying to suggest is not, you know, you get moral like bonus points a year if you go and have sex with someone that less people want to have sex with. She's talking about actually trying to the extent that we can exercise our willpower on our desire. And that seems to me, you're totally right in putting that question of acting on and not acting on aside. She's talking about wanting different things.
Actually trying to change your desire.
She references this exercise that Lindy West has written about, where she looks at photos of women who are overweight and she asks herself what it is to consider this beautiful. And the thought is that that is supposed to open her eyes to seeing or finding attractive, not seeing, but finding attractive things that she didn't find attractive before.
I had forgotten that she brought up Lindy West. I can't stand body positivity. I think I cannot stand it. It is just anathema to me. It's moralizing. It's really fucking hard to figure out a way to tell people to change their desires that isn't moralistic and that isn't actually about doing the same kind of thing to desire that supposedly queer politics was supposed to be against in the first place. The reason that I can't stand body positivity, not just because I think there's something very churchy about staring at like a photo of like someone who is fat like you are and meditating your way into affection for yourself. The reason I can't stand it is because I feel implicated. Because what it says is that my self-loathing, and I don't mean my generally, I mean mine, Andrea Long Chu's self-loathing is morally suspect, and it is the result of a lack of having had my consciousness raised. No, my self-loathing is precious to me, and it's a form of knowledge about myself, and it's also, by its own very structure, fundamentally incapable of being fixed through consciousness raising, because self-loathing is a form of consciousness. I talk all the time about this sort of scene that one can imagine if one is a woman, or even if one isn't, of standing in front of the mirror and assessing one's body, and you don't like your gut and you wish your nose were a different shape, and you have a double chin, or you feel like your breasts are too big, your breasts are too small, whatever it is. Now you can run all of your feminist analyses about how this is patriarchy and it's body phobic and it's fat phobic and it's sexist and it's the cosmetic industry. You can do all of this. And you will not at any point necessarily be wrong, but you also won't feel better. If anything, now you will feel worse because, so now you're ugly and stupid.
So in context, she begins with a group of men called incels and voluntary celibates whose main creed is to claim that they are entitled to sex. They have a right to sex. It's being denied them by evil bitches. And she just dismisses that, obviously, but then asks, do we nevertheless have this duty to work on our desires? And she says, there is no entitlement to sex, and everyone is entitled to what they want. But personal preferences, and then she delivers these titles in caps, no dicks, no femmes, no fats, no blacks, no Arabs, no rice, no spice, mask for mask, are never just personal. And that is her invitation to think about the ways in which we can work on our desires because they are themselves the result of these political processes. She says at some point, the question then is how to dwell in the ambivalent place where we acknowledge that no one is obligated to desire anyone else, that no one has a right to be desired, but also that who is desired and who isn't is a political question, a question usually answered by more general patterns of domination and exclusion. And what really puzzled me for a while is, what does it mean that she says it's a political question? I actually couldn't parse the sentence. I asked, what does it mean that it's a question? The only thing I can come up with is she means it's a problem. And I think this is the real controversial claim. Is it unjust? There's a sense in which we think, well, it's unfair that I'm not as attractive as someone else. But is it unjust? And it presents the side of the political task that some people are not drawing the same attention as others.
The scarier question is it unjust? And also, none of us actually have a moral obligation to do anything about it. That's the real question that rears its head. It's like, of course you can say any given person's desire is produced through the interplay of power relations. I mean, that's a truism of the post-Foucault academy. It's not that that's meaningless. The people who are sort of victims in the kind of ecology of desire are assumed to, by nature or by virtue of their marginalized position in that structure, to have desires of their own, which are inevitably more ethical than anyone else. I think that is a kind of moralism that can be really insidious because it implies that there are people who are so oppressed that they are not allowed to want things that are bad for them. Everyone should be allowed to want things that are bad for them. I think I'm prepared to defend that statement at least. The journalist Meredith Toulousan, who writes for this publication, Them, had this piece a year or two ago? It's relatively recent. The headline is something like, why can't my famous non-binary friends get laid? And she's talking about folks who are friends of hers and this experience that they have going on Tinder. These are friends of hers who are non-binary femmes who are having a lot of trouble getting dates. The conclusion that Meredith comes to is not dissimilar from Amya's, which is that other people's desires should change, and that these men, they should be open to their gayness being changed and becoming bi in some expansive sense or a pansexual or whatever. This is actually, according to her, is sort of a gift that trans people give the world, the sort of like inherent queering of other people's sexuality. What this misses is that the reason the gay men don't want to fuck her non-binary femme friends is because the gay men want to fuck the exact same people that her non-binary femmes want to fuck, which is masker men, ideally straight men, right? So the reason they can't have sex, the reason their desires are not compatible, is that they share the exact same fucking desire, which is to be fucked by someone who is mask enough to pass as straight. This piece, I think, is, it's not that it's not responding to a real problem. Like, it's not that there isn't real loneliness or pain. I completely affirm the affective experience of her friends on Tinder. But that's not the point. The point is, how do you adjudicate when it's not actually one person wants something that's good for them, the other person wants something that's bad? Both people want something that's basically bad for them. That's one of the ways in which I would part most strongly with Amia, is in my worry that moralism about the desires of the oppressor can be a shell corporation for moralism about the desires of the oppressed.
I think that's really, really interesting, because it means that the project that Amia is describing, and she's trying to make room for, and she's quite gentle about it, but she tries to make room for a certain kind of project of thinking critically about our own desires insofar as they reflect these political and moral prejudices. The first step is then to recognize that the desires of the people that we're now supposed to be more accommodating, that we're supposed to direct ourselves with our projects of self-fashioning, we would have to look at those. And once we start looking critically at those, it's not clear why we're looking at the desires of the oppressor to begin with. Because now it looks like the moral responsibility of the privileged to be accommodating to desires that are not any better, not any less reflective of the same discriminatory patterns. And then that makes you think that something's messed up about the question.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes, I think that is right.
And I think that's fascinating.
For our second segment of the podcast, we want to welcome in Rachel Rosenfeld, the new publisher of The New Republic and the former editor of The New Inquiry, an online magazine that she started in New York in 2009. You know, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on, Rachel, is that we just got done with this symposium on intellectuals. And in a lot of the pieces, there's a sort of hinge point in the articles about when Occupy Wall Street happens. And there's a sense that for the little magazines, particularly in New York, the writers and editors there, I think we have a sense that Occupy Wall Street was a very different experience for the people in New York than it was in Chicago, where we were a little bit more distant from it at the time. And so, you know, I'm curious, just you had started this magazine in 2009 that became very identified in some ways with what was going on at Occupy. And some of my impressions of that time come from you. So I'm curious to sort of start by just asking what you saw as your own role and the role of your magazine when Occupy Wall Street got underway.
New Inquiry came into being late 2008, 2009. It wasn't like the way most magazines are founded, with, you know, a group of people setting out to make a magazine with a sense of mission. It was sort of like me and a couple of friends grappling with the reality that the institutions of culture that previously conferred some sort of meaning or insight, they weren't reflecting back what I needed to hear. So I just started in a very feeble way to try to make sense of it, literally by starting a Tumblr called thenewinquiry.tumblr.com. And I kept being driven by this sort of idea of there being like a surplus population of people who would have otherwise, maybe if they'd been born at a different time or were of a different generation, might have gone into magazine publishing or would have been, you know, the great critics or the great academics of our generation, but were basically alienated from those institutions, many of whom were crippled by debt.
But you surely, with The New Inquiry, you had some kind of mission that went beyond just providing a platform for people who couldn't write in other places. I mean, there was a political project to it, wasn't there?
Yeah, but I think it was pre-political in a way. I didn't know what it looked like to be on the left of Democrats until I started The New Inquiry. It was actually just about the people, and Occupy happened. It was like everyone like ripped their masks off and like, you know, like they ripped their faces off. And there were like Guy Fawkes masks underneath. I didn't fully comprehend my own politics until I learned what they were from the people that I had assembled.
So take us through that moment. I mean, you say that's when the masks came off. Was that a time when you kind of realized or saw that the New Inquiry had a specific kind of mission, even compared to the other little magazines?
The editors at New Inquiry, specifically Vicki Osterweil and Max Fox and Malcolm Harris and the more anarchist-aligned editors, were telling me about this thing that was going to happen in September. They were training for it. They were like preparing like pamphlets or legal documents and like doing like de-arresting trainings. And I just felt like I was indulging them in like the DNA of Occupy. New Inquiry editors were everywhere. And then other magazines kind of came in like big, loud ways. Jacobin denounced it or sort of distanced themselves from it early on and then sort of reversed their position. I was just impressed by the prescience and by how correct the staff of the New Inquiry was.
So most people would think of Occupy Wall Street as mainly a protest movement. I mean, the people that were at the forefront of it were activists. So how did you see New Inquiry and what you were doing in relation to that? Did you think of yourself as an activist, or did you think of the writers at New Inquiry as engaging in activism?
So one thing that is notable about the New Inquiry during Occupy is that we almost never wrote about it. And partly that was because what most people would view as really minor political differences on the far left were magnified by Occupy. And I realized that my all-volunteer magazine was going to like unravel if I allowed any one group to take precedence. So I, you know, sent everyone away to write for everywhere else. So you'll see a lot of like New Inquiry editors writing pieces for other magazines during Occupy. But that was just to keep the group together. I used to joke that I was like an anarchist soccer mom, like just showing up with like Capri Suns and just, I didn't know what was happening, but I was like doing what I could. You know, eventually, like, you know, New Inquiry editors were meeting people in Occupy who ended up becoming, like, Natasha Leonard, for instance, was a discovery of Occupy, and many others, Nathan Jurgensen, and so on. They kind of came into New Inquiry because they met us during Occupy, and then with these new voices, I was able to provide a platform that was durable, that actually outlasted a lot of the social and action-based affinity groups that were really vital to the success of Occupy, which, by the way, I view as very successful. If you want to talk about that later, we can. But like the manifestation of that would continue in and through this platform. And I think that's been true, but also it's evolved. I don't view myself as an activist. I view myself as somebody who gives platform to ideas that compel me. And activists, they don't have more insight than other people per se, but they have something that the New York publishing universe isn't really prepared to understand and process. And so the originality that you can find and the foresight that I think that New Inquiry has often had about political matters is because there's a strong connection with people that are really out there and actually know, as opposed to like speculating upon the events of the world.
So you just mentioned how the legacy media wasn't really able to account for Occupy and didn't really know what to make of it. And you just recently became publisher of The New Republic, congratulations, which is one of those legacy publications. And I actually interned at The New Republic not long after Occupy in 2012. And when I was there, the people on staff were very skeptical of the whole Occupy movement and were much more interested in sort of the Washington Palace intrigue. So as publisher of The New Republic and someone who had a very different kind of experience with Occupy, how do you plan on interacting with that history?
Well, I would say that what you're describing is certainly a legacy of the New Republic, but it's a highly selective one, and it's one that does tend to get told. But the New Republic has a longer history than that and a more interesting one than that. And it starts as the major American publication of the progressive era. I'm much more interested in the version of the New Republic that articulated very well with Occupy Wall Street and that was prepared to understand what it was looking at, which I don't think was the case for the last 40 years of this publication.
The New Republic has always been this sort of standard bearer for, you know, left of center politics. But I guess what I want to know is, with so many magazines in the space right now, what do you see the political role of the New Republic being in the future?
I think being prescriptive about it is exactly not what the New Republic would do. I see the New Republic as being rooted largely in a methodology. Part of that methodology is an attentive and brave and bold capacity and willingness to actually understand the problems of the world. So where the New Republic is going to fall in terms of the left, I don't even know that it needs to map onto any kind of understanding we have of the right or the left. It just depends on what the circumstances of the world demands of us.
So one last question. You mentioned that you consider Occupy successful. 5 years after Occupy, obviously, we had the election of Donald Trump. So I'm curious, I mean, you're not the first I've heard make that claim, but I'm curious what it means to consider Occupy a success right now.
Success doesn't necessarily look like electoral politics, having a candidate put forward. What matters is that it was right about its moment and the material conditions and Occupy. Well, I think it was transformative for everyone that experienced it in New York. And nobody that's part of it even thinks in terms of Democrat and Republican. It's the kind of imagination that would have given Bernie a real chance at being the Democratic nominee. And that is extraordinary.
We didn't start the fire, though it's always burning since the world's been turning. We didn't start the fire, though we didn't light it, though we tried to fight it.
When you get a chance, would you please call your mother?
The last segment of the show, John calls his mom to consult about politics, daily affairs.
Do I have to?
Yeah, you have to, John. Okay, call your mom, okay. John.
Okay.
Hello, hi Mom. Welcome to the Rather Be Reading podcast.
Hi John.
Hi Judy.
Hey.
You were reading?
Yeah.
Perfect.
I was reading The Point.
Oh.
I was reading the Homelander story.
Oh, this sounds canned, but actually we wanted to ask you, something about Herland. Herland is an essay in our issue by Nora Bricker about reading feminist utopian fiction to think about Me Too. And over the years, we've talked a lot about Doris Lessing and the effect that her fiction had on you growing up as a feminist and as a political person. And I was curious to hear you talk a little bit about that.
Hey, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of her, but you're right. It's a really great connection. Doris Lessing was amazing. She was the first writer that I read that saw women as powerful people who could do whatever they wanted to do and not be dependent on men. And I read her at a really impressionable time, like probably right after college, when I was, 21, 22 years old. And to me, it was revolutionary at the time. My most favorite book was called The Golden Notebook, and it was just amazing. So I read everything I could get my hands on that she wrote, and I thought it was really important in terms of how I became and, what I wanted to do in my life.
Judy, I wanted to ask you, we hear a lot of reports about women's experiences in the workplace and in academia and elsewhere of sexual harassment. And I was wondering, do you get a sense that things have changed much since when you were younger?
I think it's really hard to tell. You know, I was one of the first females in the newsroom at CBS TV in Chicago, at WBBM TV, and I felt like I was treated pretty much with respect by the newsroom. And in terms of the management, the first person, his name was Bob Ferranti, who was the news director, was fantastic. But then a new news director came in, and he immediately saw me as less than and didn't want me doing a lot of stuff that I decided to do. So that was my experience in terms of sort of the discrimination. In terms of sexual harassment, I would hear about it from some of my friends, but I didn't experience it in that newsroom.
How did you handle the situation with the new news director?
Well, I tried, and, you know, I had been assigned because I had come out of politics when I went into the newsroom. So I had been assigned to prepare all the reporters for news interviews that they were doing, especially when they had panels or when they had political specials to do. When this guy came in, he really just sort of took me out of all that, and I don't even remember what he had me doing, but it wasn't interesting to me. So how I handled it was I moved to NBC. Because, I mean, it was just clear I couldn't do the stuff there that I wanted to do.
Do you have any advice? You have lived and you've raised two daughters, and do you have any advice for younger women trying to battle harassment and discrimination?
Well, it seems to me that now there's a lot more possibility that they will be believed. At least if they raise their voices, they're going to be heard. My main advice always is just to be straight, be honest, and confront when things don't feel right. I've seen women make a lot of sacrifices for their career that did not make them feel very good inside. And I think that's a mistake. You know, I just think you have to stay true to yourself, and you have to have integrity, and you have to confront. I came from a family where people confronted each other easily, so that was always...
Me too.
Yeah, you did too, yes.
Okay, you did it, but you did a really good job with John, so thanks, Judy. Rachel has a question for you too.
You mentioned that you had come from a background in politics. We just got off the phone with Rachel Rosenfeld, who is the new publisher of The New Republic. And we were talking about the legacy of Occupy. And I was wondering, what do you think about Occupy? Do you think it was successful?
Rachel considers it a success. And I consider it
a failure.
Yeah.
I think it was great at raising the issues, no question about it. But I think it was really a failure in terms of getting anything done. They eschewed politics. Like, we won't discuss politics. Well, the way the Tea Party functioned, you know, they started on ideological grounds, but they quickly understood that if they really wanted to make change, they had to get political, and they had to elect candidates, and they did. And I feel like Occupy just ran away from that. They never took that on and understood that if they really wanted to make change, they had to get involved in the political system. I wouldn't consider it a total failure, because it certainly raised issues that I think were important to raise. But I consider it a failure in terms of making change, because look what we've got.
Do you think that from when you worked in electoral politics in the 60s, did you feel that there was more of an awareness or a relationship between the people sort of working in electoral politics and the social movements, the protesters, than there are today? Or is this sort of a split you've always seen within the Democratic base?
No, I think Occupy was kind of distinctive. I mean, I see too many people on the left being so pure that they're like, oh, well, we don't really deal with politics. And I'm like, are you kidding? That's how things happen. If you want to do big change, you have to get involved in politics. And I would say that now, I think that the one plus of the Trump administration has been just a huge motivation for young people to get involved, for everybody to get involved. For all those people, the Bernie people who sat out the last election because they didn't think Hillary was progressive enough, you know, I want to say that elections are about a choice between two people, so you better choose.
Speaking of that, Mom, do you have any favorites yet for 2020?
No, I don't. I see some people that I think are good, but I just think we have to wait and see what happens. Bernie, for example, I mean, I like Bernie. I voted for Bernie, but I hope he doesn't run again. He'd be in his 80s when he was in office. I think that's crazy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. Okay.
That was
thanks,
awesome.
Judy.
Thanks,
bye.
Mom.
Thanks.
See you later at dinner.
Bye.
Wait, John, I want to ask you a question. Did you drive?
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, This land was made for you and me.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 3 of Rather Be Reading. Until next time.
Make love, did you say?
Yes.
What do you mean? You don't even know my psychocardiogram.
Eh?
Well, on Earth, for centuries, people haven't made love unless their psychocardiogram readings were in perfect confluence.
I know nothing of that.
Well, all right. But I don't see what good it will do.
I'm going down to the library, picking out a book, check it in, check it out. Gonna say hi to the dictionary, picking out a book, check it in, check it out.